Welcome to today's session on an examination of the legislative framework governing commuter safety in the Queensland mining industry. Today, Candice Porter will be presenting. She's a PhD scholar with the Queensland University of Technology's Centre for Accident Research and Road Safety, Queensland, short form CASQ. Candice commenced her PhD with CASQ following her undergraduate degree in business management and her master's in applied social research. Her interest in work-related commuting stems from her experience managing compulsory third parties and workers' compensation claims. This experience provided a background for her understanding and interest in legislation, as well as the influence of policy development on worker behaviour. She has been able to leverage the skills developed in these roles to examine the legislative underpinnings and policy frameworks associated with her research. And please welcome Candice.
Thank you. This is nowhere as near as scary as I thought it was going to be, because thank you for the three of you for coming. And Mary, I really appreciate it. So as mentioned, I'm going to be presenting today on the legislative framework governing commuter safety in the Queensland mining industry. This is some research that I've been conducting with my supervisors, Jeremy Davey, Kerry Armstrong and James Freeman, and we work out of the Centre for Accident Research and Road Safety in Queensland, which is a joint initiative of the Motor Accident Insurance Commission and the Queensland University of Technology. So first, a bit of an overview as to what I'll be talking about today. So first, we'll have a chat about commuting in the mining industry. Then we'll have a look at the legislation regulation. We'll look at the industry standards, regulated organisational policy documents, and I'll draw some observations, make some conclusions. So what do I mean by commuting? Commuting is a term given to the journey of a worker to and from their permanent home, or in some cases from site accommodation to the site, that's specifically with the mining industry. Commuting can involve the daily commute from the mine site or the commute to the worker's permanent home at the beginning or end of a work cycle or roster. It can involve air travel, driving, taking a company-provided bus, carpooling, or there are other means of transportation. I'm focusing today on road transport and the commute to and from the worker's permanent home at the beginning or end of a work cycle or roster. So what's the interest? Well, there was a coronial inquiry which investigated the deaths of two mine workers travelling after shift and a police officer travelling to shift. These accidents occurred in 2005 and 2007, and they were two separate motor vehicle accidents. Now, the key purpose of this inquest was really to investigate if fatigue significantly contributed to the incidents. The findings, however, weren't reported until February 2011, and this is potentially because of the really complex and sensitive inquiries that were going on in relation to this inquiry. The inquest made some recommendations on the implications resulting from a travelling workforce, organisations running a 24-hour-a-day operation, as well as driver fatigue. Now, there's been a concentration in relation to fatigue driving in industry, and this is potentially because of the control that industry has over fatigue-related driving issues. Now, we know that fatigue results in a diminished capacity for work, decrements in attention, perception, decision-making, and decrements in skill and performance. So potentially, because of the control that organisations have over this risk, that's why organisations are choosing to focus their attention on fatigue-related driving. Now, there's lots of research which suggests that mine workers are at risk of fatigue-related incidents while driving, and some research demonstrates that approximately 23% of workers describe that they're falling asleep at the wheel in the past 12 months. Now, that's a self-reported statistic. So this is perhaps why there's a concentration on fatigue and fatigue plans associated with commuting behaviours. There are other risks, though, and this might be risks such as rural and remote driving. Now, rural and remote driving are likely to result in serious or catastrophic injuries, if not death. Some research which was conducted through CARSQ suggested that these catastrophic injuries are technically because of the high speed, monotonous nature of the driving, the high likelihood of head-on collisions and a higher potential to run off the road. Also, if a crash occurs, the remoteness of the crash may mean that there's a long time until help arrives. Also, from an organisational perspective, the trend of driving following shift blocks is becoming more common practice. Now, this is probably because of the remote location of the work site. Also, the legislation is supporting an increase in shift length, so that results in 7-day rosters or 21-day rosters, and then a period of time which the worker can take off. So that means that the workers are actually residing on the coast rather than close to their work site. Also, mining companies are under increased production pressures, and because lots of mine workers are engaging in this type of behaviour, it's almost like it's become okay to do it. So it's really supporting their practice in the minds of the workforce. Now, the fact that workers see this behaviour as okay can be seen by the distances these workers are travelling to get to and from work. So in a current study, 386 workers' responses drawn from a Bowen Basin mine site, we found that 71% of these workers were driving more than 200 kilometres to get to their residential address to work. 50% of the workers surveyed were travelling more than 400 kilometres, and incredibly, 31% of these workers were travelling more than 600 kilometres to get to and from home. And also, the Safe Work Australia statistics demonstrate this is a problem, given it is the highest commuter fatality rate of industries. The stats were drawn from 2010 and 11 at 2.5 times the national rate. So how is commuting currently being managed in the mining industry? Well, there was a guidance note that was released in Queensland, and that talks about this concept of journey management. This focuses on this issue as a fatigue-related risk. The concept of journey management is really to control the risk by managing and considering hours driven, distances travelled, and hours driven before and after a rostered shift. So how is this concept of journey management, and more generally commuting, supported by regulations, standards, policy documents, as well as organisations? Well, as the name of this presentation suggests, I'm really looking at the framework that governs commuting safety in Queensland mining industry, but more specifically how this framework supports the concept of journey management. There are four layers that make up the framework that guides journey management practices in Queensland. That's the legislation regulation, industry standards, regulated policy documents, and internal organisational policy. Now, as you're probably aware, each layer is informed by the preceding layer and becomes more specific to the organisation as it approaches it. For example, the legislation provides a really broad risk management framework, and the internal organisational policy is really related to the nuances of the organisation, its operating environment and its workers. So I'm going to discuss each layer of the legislative framework and draw some key points which have the potential to impact organisational journey management controls. So first, let's have a look at the legislation and regulation. So workplace safety in Queensland mining, there are really various interrelated legislative requirements that govern safety in the Queensland mining industry. These requirements, as mentioned, are provided broad and result in a strong proactive safety-orientated focus, and it fits within a risk management framework and generally, in a nutshell, contains the same objectives as other safety legislation, for example, the Workplace Health and Safety Act. And these safety legislation basically sit within this risk management framework, tools such as identifying the risk, performing a risk assessment, implementing some type of control, and then monitoring and reviewing the control. So the legislation sets a general standard which must be achieved by an employer, but really the specific way that the general outcome is achieved is really up to the employer and the way it interprets the legislation. So a primary objective of the Queensland mining legislation relates to an employer's responsibility to manage risks associated with on-site activities. Now, the word on-site is really important here because it really really draws together what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make. So by implementing these tools such as fatigue management plans and safe operating procedures. Now, as I mentioned, because the legislation sets a general standard which must be achieved by an employer, and the way the employer achieves this is at their discretion, attempts to implement journey management plans have tended to be more ad hoc and typically associated with fatigue. So once an employee leaves the site and drives onto a public road, they themselves also have a responsibility as a road user to act appropriately and to protect themselves and other road users. Now, these responsibilities include driving for the prevailing conditions, taking appropriate rest breaks, and acknowledging the relevant traffic laws. And this results really in the responsibility between the employee and employer once the employee leaves the mine site as being really blurred because of the competing responsibilities of the employer to provide a safe work environment for the employee and the employee responsible for their driving practices on the road. The Queensland Workers' Compensation Scheme is something that I have also considered. It's one of two schemes to provide cover to workers for their journey to and from work without really significant restrictions. It provides compensation to workers injured in crashes while commuting. It operates as a no-fault system for costs associated with rehabilitation, medical treatment, as well as providing an allowance for weekly benefits. But there's been ongoing industry debate regarding journey claims, suggesting that commuting is arguably outside the bounds of the work site and that the employer has no real control over the employee's actions once they leave the work site. As highlighted in a recent review of the workers' compensation scheme in Queensland, there are benefits of journey claims, and these include the availability of rehabilitation weekly benefits for the workers if they're involved in an accident to and from work. It also really takes the stress out of rehabilitation process for the worker because they're provided with a case manager to manage their rehabilitation process. And there's also vocational support to return and return to work assistance associated with a workers' compensation claim in Queensland. The Queensland scheme requires workers to commence their journey without significant deviation or delay. But anecdotal evidence specifically drawn from the coronial inquest suggests that these workers are really concerned that they wouldn't be covered if they were to take a rest break before they commenced their journey. Now, I know that this is not the case. However, the perception in the industry is that if they were to engage in a rest break, they wouldn't actually be covered. So this concern really has the potential to exacerbate this culture of commuting immediately following the end of shift, which is a real problem for commuting behaviour in the Queensland mining industry. The other point I'd like to make regarding the Queensland Workers' Compensation Scheme is that journey claims don't actually directly impact the employers financially. There's no impact on an employer's premium, except for some exceptions like self-insurers where they foot the bill themselves. So that means that there's no actual way to enforce a proactive journey management approach in this instance. Now, what I mean by that is the employer might throw their hands up in the air and say, well, it's not going to affect me if there's a claim, so what's the point of me really making any effort to change this scenario? So the scheme really has the potential to limit a proactive management approach of organisations in respect to commuting in the Queensland industry. Let's have a look at some industry standards. Recently, there was a guidance note for fatigue risk management released in Queensland, and it's authored by the Department of Natural Resources and Mines. It was released earlier this year in 2013. It was released as a tool to assist organisations to comply with safety legislation. It's a guidance note, so it's more prescriptive than the legislation and it really guides the organisation towards compliance. It was drawn from other jurisdictions around Australia. It really provides direction and control to the risks associated with fatigue, and there are references in the note regarding commuting. Specifically, the references the talk about when a journey management plan is required. Now, these might be that the employee resides more than an hour from site, that they regularly work 12-hour shifts or longer, that they may exceed 16 hours of wakefulness while in control of a vehicle, and that they might be required as needing a plan in accordance with the guidance note risk factor tables. These indicators are not specifically related to commuting or work issues, but by looking at the complete document, the picture becomes really clear that the focus of these journey management plans is actually associated with ensuring workers are arriving at work, fit for work, and refreshed. So journey management examples provided in the guidance note, as suggested, relate to specifically to on-site issues. So issues such as, do workers have to travel more than 2 hours to arrive on site for their first shift? Examples such as, sites with organised travel should be aware that those who are commuting for long distances may already have a limited sleep opportunity. Again, another fitness for work issue. And also, the first day shift in particular has been found difficult due to the transition between normal sleep-wake times of workers at home and the adapted sleep-wake times required for work. So as you can see, there's really continued reference to fitness for work rather than, can I say, fitness to commute. And it really centres around this risk as a fatigue-related risk rather than other sort of risks associated with rural and remote driving or driving in general. Let's have a look at some the regulated and organisational policy documents. So these are really prescriptive safety documents which at an organisational level are tailored to the organisation. And they might include fatigue management plans and safe operating procedures. I've really focused on the fatigue management plans here because they're really the only organisational policy document that talks about commuting. And basically, fatigue management plans are made up of talking about on-site risks, hours of work or work scheduling concerns, as well as this fitness for work. So commuting is typically briefly mentioned in fatigue management plans and other organisation-specific documents. They really focus on an on-site related risk, such as hours of work or work scheduling concerns. So by work scheduling, what I mean is they make sure, the employer makes sure that they schedule really laborious type work earlier in the day rather than later in the day to really manage the fatigue related risk. The association of fatigue management plans with fitness for work results in a target journey management plan for journeys to work, but really doesn't consider the journey home as closely. And that results in the fact that attempts to address this off-site behaviour have tended to be really more ad hoc and on an as-needs basis. Really interestingly, talking to safety managers from the mine site that I'm working with about this issue, about the focus on trips to work and not the trips home, they suggest that their actual primary concern and the things that they've been trying to manage is actually the journey home rather than the journey to work. So that's really counterintuitive to what I'm finding by reviewing all these policy documents, and the perception out there by the safety managers is actually contrary to what we're finding by reviewing the policy documents. So some observations. In the example of the Queensland mining industry, the legislation really doesn't compel a proactive journey management plan, and it results in organisations focusing and concentrating on a fitness for work and really ignores an employer's fitness to commute. The legislation as it currently stands in Queensland refers to the implementation of safety, health and management plan for site-related activities. So those activities that actually fall within the definition of the site. And also regulated policy documents are really drafted in respect to on-site safety issues. So there are no real specific policies in respect to commuting, and if there are, they're really associated with the trip to work and not the trip home. The industry policy documents concentrate on fatigue driving risk as a key risk for drive-in, drive-out workers, and that That means that fatigue risk management and policies associated with stress really fall within the scope of the organisation's fatigue management plan, which is associated with on-site issues. The categorisation of this risk as a fatigue-related risk rather than a road safety risk means that important road safety issues are really being ignored by employers. And there's also an obligation on the employee in respect to the safe and responsible driving on the road, which has really blurred the apportionment of responsibilities between employer and employee in this instance. So overall, the safety and compensation legislation in Queensland really doesn't compel employers to be proactive about the issue of commuting. There's a real blurred understanding between the responsibility between employee and employer regarding this issue. Any attempt to address this issue has typically focused on the commute to work and has ignored the commute home because this real focus on fitness to work and on-site risks. And as a result, the training and education of employees is really categorised in relation to on-site risks and hours of work concerns rather than driver education. So where to from here? Well, this research part forms part of my PhD project, which aims to explore the influences on worker commuting behaviour. The first part of this research really looks at the context in which a worker commuting occurs. So I've looked at legislation and enforcement, organisational policies and employment structures, which is what I've discussed here today. And following studies, I plan to investigate the influences on individual commuting decisions. So looking at individual attitudes about commuting and commuting behaviours and social and cultural influences such as the influence of family and work colleagues on this commuting behaviour. Any questions?
Oh. So, first of all, thank you, because that's pretty cool what you've done. I'll try to limit my questions in what I imagine is the scope of your doctorate, your doctoral thesis.
Yeah, sure.
A couple of observations that may or may not help you do with it as you wish. Firstly, on some statistics, your milestone of 2.5 times the average accident rate.
Mm.
I wonder if you split that into to work and from work.
Mm.
I imagine the to work statistic is probably equal to your state average, suggesting that your from work would be 5 times your state average.
Yeah.
So that might be interesting.
And that would be interesting.
Right. Yeah. So if you split the two and break out the statistics into to and from, I suspect the from work statistic will pop a lot higher.
Mm.
The other thing that you might do to really emphasise it is if you normalise for kilometres travelled, it would probably still be higher than the national average, but it will give you a stronger basis for argument.
Mm.
So that's an observation, do as you wish.
Yeah.
I guess the interesting questions would be, let's start with the culture.
Mm.
Is it true your average mine worker probably has a different level of risk acceptance to your normal person in the state?
Mm.
So if that is true, any attempt to overlay a fitness to commute, which, by the way, I love that term,
Thanks.
A fitness to commute framework has to be adapted to this higher than average risk-taking culture.
Yep.
So you're trying to convince blokes who reckon they're bulletproof in the first place.
Yeah.
So have you given any thought to how that risk acceptance culture comes into it?
No, not yet. I think that's going to really come out and I'm going to get some ideas as to how that might work once I start really investigating and doing some qualitative work with the mine workers themselves, which is my next study. I think that will really give me an understanding as to how their thought processes work and how acceptance of risk they are, like acceptable of the risk they are. I think that will give me a more complete picture. At the moment, it's just been an investigation of how all this, the context of it, how does it all fit in? Because at the moment, nobody's really looked at why it's happening, why the legislation is either supporting or not supporting that sort of thing.
And I guess the next question that's forming in my head is, do you know the vehicles that travel, are they often filled with a number of workers, or are they individuals in their own cast?
Yeah, so some work that I've been doing recently up at the mine site that I'm working with have suggested that things like the ice machine will run out of ice on the end of shifts because all the guys decide that they want to fill up their eskies and carpool to get home. And they all the guys around them get boozed, and the driver then takes his turn the next time round.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's a real culture of carpooling, but carpooling to have fun while you're going home, to make sure that have a bit of a drink and wind down.
And maybe then the driver just limits himself to 5 or 6 beers.
Potentially, that's right.
Okay.
But I thought that was really interesting. But, yeah.
Yeah, and I think the higher level question, I'm going to hand over to other parts of the audience here. The higher level question is, I really liked how ultimately the policy framework from the government down stops, making sure the on-site activities and the risk management is in place to limit the at-work incidents. But clearly the policy framework kind of runs out and it's really blurred lines.
Exactly.
But it occurs to me that maybe the focus of the employer is directly at odds with the fitness to commute, because they're trying to get the most out of their workers from the shift, and by rights they could be held to say, well, I want the guys absolutely exhausted at the end of the shift, that way I know I've got my money out of them.
Yeah.
But good luck getting home. Have you investigated that?
No, I haven't. I mean, I think if that's the attitude that's going on, then I think there's some greater problems going at play here, because I really think that the issue is that they need to start concentrating on the trip home, because it's if not more risky than the trip to work. From a road safety perspective, from an employer perspective, I can understand why they want to engage their workers like that and really try and get the most out of them, and then say, okay, well, you've finished your shift. And there's some really there are employers who provide accommodation. In fact, probably all of them provide accommodation after shift. But whether the employee actually takes that up, it's their own time. So they say, well, it's my own time. I want to get home to my wife and kids. So what we're really looking at is, why is that happening? Why is that individual behaviour happening? And that's why we're going to investigate the work side, the colleague influence, the family influence, and the individual attitude toward this behaviour in general.
Oh no!
Okay. Sarah just wants to stir me up.
I told you I wouldn't handle. I mean, that's really interesting. That perception out there is that they wouldn't be covered if they have a rest break, because certainly it's built into the legislation, but not clear that if you delay your journey. And the reasons for that are reasonable. Now, any insurer is going to cover you if you take a rest break, because heavens, that's reasonable.
Yeah.
And it's more likely to have a flow-on effect if you have less accidents.
Exactly.
But certainly it's our experience that employers don't have any incentive to do anything about the journey, because it's outside their control, and they really do throw their hands up and say,
yeah,
okay. So that's interesting.
I'll ask a question of pure ignorance, because I'm from Comcare and we don't have mine anything.
Journey.
You were saying that there is no sort of like financial implications or for the employer, but if they're covered for their journey, isn't that reflected in their premium or?
So my understanding is that it's not actually taken into account in the calculation of premium in Queensland.
Indirectly,
it would be, because it has to go across the industry, somebody's got to pay for it. But I mean, from our understanding, yeah, we might understand it that way. But an employer just reads a paragraph that's listed on WorkCover's website and says journey claims don't affect your premium, and they go, cool.
It doesn't
affect my premium. I don't really care then.
The way that the formula works in Queensland is very large employers usually, and the sizing factor is so huge for them that they are so influenced so minutely by the industry rates, which is where the journey claims
comes
are
into
built
play.
Into. So the very large mining company that I worked with was 96% was all about their own premiums. So 4% is actually these journey claims. But they took it very seriously from a different perspective because they had a fatality. And the CEO of that company took it very personally that somebody had died, interestingly, on the way to work.
Oh, really?
Not on the way home.
Yeah,
which worries me about the culture.
Yeah.
About what they would do. Because you say employers will probably try and get the most out of them right to the end. I say these people are probably trying to get the most out of their time off right to the very end.
Yeah.
So this guy
that's true.
From a party.
Yeah.
And that's something that I probably haven't considered from that perspective.
Which it'll be interesting to come
that
out of.
Once I do my qualitative interviews with the workers.
Have you ever looked at the types of roles coming to and from the mine site? Like, are they all bitumen roles or is there something, are they just dirt roles?
Majority of them bitumen because the mines are actually obligated under other legislation to make sure that all the infrastructure leading into their mine site is actually quite sufficient. So these mine sites are putting in rail and massive roads to cater for the influx in transportation around.
So obviously it's not the roads and it's not the cars, they're not using old bombs that they're driving because they're not something to and from the town.
Yes and no, there are mentions of people using bombs, so the bomb will be the one that the guy drives to work and he leaves the good car at home with his wife because she needs to take the kids to work. So he doesn't want her to take the bomb because he wants him and his kids... her and the kids to be safe to go to work, and he'll take the bomb to the mine site.
And that's the other thing, driving in and out of the mine. Yeah. Why would you take the good car?
No, that's my point. I'm just saying, if they are driving the bombs, and obviously the maintenance is always a bit slack on it, then is it all to do with the fatigue, or is it something to do with the vehicle they're driving that are causing the issues? I mean, the longer you drive, obviously, the more likely to have an injury, and if you're running in a car that's possibly maybe not service as much as it should have been, so you've got that issue, so that might be something to...
Something as well to consider.
Coming back to the fitness to work, and particularly you just said, the guys might use their leisure time most effectively. So is there effectively a breathalyzer, or is there the safety manager does a check? The individual worker to say, if I look at you, you're off to go, or it's kind of like they just walk in.
Is this after the shift or before the shift? So before the shift, there's some administrative frameworks that they put in place, such as like a tick and flick self-report fatigue plan. So they report on their own fatigue levels, whether they've had 10 hours sleep the night before or and how long they've commuted for. Well, that's in my experience with the particular mine site I'm on, and I can't comment for all mine sites, but that's how they operate it. There's also random drug and alcohol tests, which are also implemented to test for substance abuse. But I mean, it's really a self-report, and I suppose if a supervisor recognised that there was some sort of fatigue impairment, then they would be able to comment and perhaps send the worker off to have a rest in the site accommodation, because most of these sites are so remote that they've got their own site accommodation, so that is possible. But I'm not sure of the experience of that, like how frequently it happens, if it happens at all, because that means that there's a downtime for one worker. So is it really possible to take that worker off site when you've got no replacement for it? Because what we've got is shift crews that are working, and they rotate between night and day shift, and then they don't have any replacements for those crews, and then the next week the next crews come on and replace them, and the other two crews go off on their rostered time off. So with no replacements, I don't think that would, I mean, and from my pure own thoughts about the industry, I don't know whether that would actually happen, whether that actually enforce a break if they identify fatigue.
So they're thinking, extend that to the end of shift, you know, would they look at them in the eye and say, A, maybe you have to double up because I've worked here, turn up, I'm prepared to do the next 12-hour shift, I'm fine, you know me. Did they double up? Did you get a knock on the head that you didn't report? Was something happen on at the coalface that might impair your ability to drive? Is that check at the end? Now, I suspect the answer is no.
Mm.
I suspect the policy framework is silent on it.
Mm.
Ultimately, where I'm getting to is the potential for, officially, where the policy framework frays out, so it becomes less clear, this is where you're testing, where does the potential for civil liability begin?
Yeah.
Under the employment practices?
Yeah. And that's a good question, and I think it's relatively untested, as Sarah said then. There are a few cases which have been gone to court, and the names of those cases escape me right now. I have read them, but I think there's a really strong argument to escape any liability from a criminal perspective if the employee was to drive home and kill someone on the way home. From a civil perspective, I think the employer would have a really good chance of convincing that the employer had some sort of negligence associated with the fact that they let them go when they were tired and they knew they were tired. It's sometimes pretty easy to explain away risk management frameworks which are perhaps not entirely implemented, such as instances like this.
And my last question, I promise.
That's right.
Has any measurement been done on the level of fatigue at the end of shift? So, in other words, to compare it to, you have a blood alcohol reading of X, that's the degree of impairment.
So, not specifically in relation to mine workers. We do know that fatigue related problems are equivalent to a certain blood alcohol reading, and that's based on other fatigue research. Now that's something like 2.5 times the blood alcohol limit when you've had 24 hours of wakefulness or something like that. I can't remember exactly, but it's something really, really high for a short amount of time.
Yeah. Because if an employer, say it was a bartender, and the employer said, your job is to have a drink with lonely guys who wander in. That's your job.
Mm.
It does happen. And at the end of the shift, if you've done your job properly, i.e. you fully lick it up, then off you go, they'd be upright.
Yeah.
And yet, on an equivalent scale, we know fatigue has simple and independent effects.
Mm.
But we don't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Is fatigue of a worker on a on-site monitor during the shift,
Well, there's no real physiological way to measure fatigue. That's what they do. As far as I'm aware, there's no physiological way. I stand corrected if there is, if someone knows of a way. But that's why they do self-reported. And self-reported has biases. And especially when the employee doesn't want to miss out on a wage because they need to go home and sleep. It's really problematic when you bring in the worker themselves to say, yes, I'm tired, or no, I'm not. Yeah.
Any more questions?
Have you actually looked at, from the workers' comp side of things, like all the different types of things that are causing those injuries?
What was that, sorry?
So the workers' compensation scheme, like you can get access to data, obviously, to of all the injuries, and just having a look at what are the mechanisms and the agencies that are causing those injuries to and from work. I remember it's a car, or is it because they hit a kangaroo? Is it because they were driving back at 3 in the morning and they run off the road because they...
It's not collected. It's pretty limited in what's collected in relation to journey claims.
But you probably have time of day.
Time of day.
Brief description.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, so it is possible. It is probably possible.
No, I'm just trying to help
you. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah, of course,
just
of course.
Just see how much of it is fatigue, because we know that back in, 2000 and... 9/10 or 8/9, we had a huge spike in transport. The individual fatality, we had 38 in 1 year, and was around the 20, then fell back down next year. What we found out, we did an investigation with World Cover, and the thing we found out was single vehicle accidents in just before dusk, up north. There were just trucks, just guys falling asleep on the road and just running away. Well, we presume they were falling asleep and just riding off the road in big trucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's some really nice background information for this, but it's dependent on whether that's released. whether I can get my hands on that sort of information is the other thing.
I'll be interested.
Fantastic. I'll give you my business card. Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming, the four of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.